In the words of Thomas King, if we stop telling stories and reading the books, we would discover that neglect is as powerful an agent as war and fire. Murdered, Gladys Tolley, an Algonquin woman
missing
from Kitigansi,
Maisie
Anishinaabeg, was struck and killed by a Sûreté du Québec patrol car on October 6, 2001.
Missing,
she left
Shannon
behind
Alexander,
a loving family who has been serving in the Maniwaki, Quebec area. Maisie is 6 feet tall, has brown eyes and black
Bridget,
hair. She has a pierced left nostril
and
two piercings to the death bottom lip. Please sign the following petition.
Shannon is 5'9", weighs 145 pounds.
Has brown eyes and brown, black
If you have
hair.
Any information about the whereabouts of Maisie, ears.
Please contact Sûreté du Québec at
819-310-left-knee.
Murdered, Tiffany Morrison,
Kitigansi BC Police Department.
Age 25, from the Mohawk Territory of Ganawage, outside Montreal.
If you have any information about the whereabouts of Shannon, please contact the Sûreté du Québec.
The Ganawage peacekeepers have asked that anyone with information
on the disappearance of Tiffany Morrison contact Ed Stacy.
There is this thing. Do you realize
what is?
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness?
It is estimated that over 700 Native women in Canada have gone missing or been murdered since 1980. And it seems like mainstream Canadian society simply doesn't care. Based on gathering stories in the Walk for Justice, Gladys Radek and Bernice Williams estimate that the actual number is far greater, with over 2,000 missing and murdered Native women. Indigenous women in Canada are 5 times more likely to die of a violent death than any other group of women. When we hear about missing and murdered Native women, we often associate this being an issue just in the prairies or in British Columbia along the Highway of Tears. Violence against Native women affects every single part of this country, every province, every city, every town, and every community that you call home. Here in Montreal, we are on Mohawk territory, and we call this land our home. It is thanks to the Mohawk people that we are able to coexist on their land. The issue of violence against Native women does not just take place in provinces far away. It takes place in your very own backyard, in and around the communities surrounding Montreal. Today, we will tell the stories of Tiffany Morrison, Gladys Tolley, Shannon Alexander, and Maisie Ogic. In the following radio documentary, we will honor the lives of these women and their families and ensure that their stories are told.
Today, I share a story to recognize a history that has been subordinated by the mainstream Canadian assumptions of what is valid, true, or important. I share a story to honor a life. I share a story in solidarity, and I share a story as a means of resistance. The impact of storytelling through oral transmission within the Cree Nation has been and continues to prove to be a formidable force against all acts of violence by the Canadian state. If I tell this story in the right way, then battles become massacres. And if I tell this story in the right way, then we all become characters who have a responsibility to acknowledge the crimes that are daily committed on the bodies of Aboriginal women.
That was the voice of Megan Bertison, a young Cree woman from Kinaseosipi, or Fish River, First Nation in Manitoba, telling the story of Helen Betty Osborne, a Cree woman from her community who was brutally murdered on November 13, 1971. It would take at least 10 years before someone was convicted of Betty's murder, and this was no coincidence. In order for us to understand the origins of the high rates of violence against Indigenous women that we now see in Canada, a very long and thorough history lesson is necessary. But for the purposes of this piece, a brief history lesson will have to do. Megan Bertison speaks about the ongoing history of colonization in Canada and its impacts on the present-day devaluation of Aboriginal women.
Aboriginal women not only held the exclusive ability to bear life, but they housed vast amount of knowledge, and they were respected and entrusted with the responsibility to distribute communal resources. At the height of the fur trade, a plethora of Western European men immigrated to this land in an attempt to make their fortune. It soon became apparent that most newcomers were unable to cope with this land's vast and varied landscape that was often unforgiving to strangers. It was by the grace of Aboriginal women that most, if not all, of these men survived. So if we fast forward from the fur trade to the mid-20th century, we can see a dramatic transformation in the perceived value of Aboriginal women. Suddenly, Aboriginal women were slandered and discarded by the very community of settlers they had once saved and protected. The impact of ongoing colonization and its genocidal impulses proved to have a terrible effect on all Aboriginal nations within the new Canadian boundaries. Most First Nation communities were coerced into signing modern treaties with private companies to exchange their natural resources for finite sums of money that would run out a lot sooner than those resources would. With the transition from subsistence economies to settler economies, not only were livelihoods destroyed, but intricate systems of education, knowledge, social arrangements, and spirituality were fractured.
Every single Indigenous woman who has gone missing has a story. Every family of that woman can tell a story with many of the same common themes. They are stories of police neglect, a huge lack of media attention, and government failure to address the overarching and urgent issue of violence against Native women. These families tell stories of having nowhere to turn other than the police, who are themselves perpetrators of racial profiling and violence against Aboriginal people, and who are notorious for not properly addressing cases of missing and murdered Native women with the same urgency they would a case of a white woman gone missing. On reserve, Native police forces have also failed time after time again to properly deal with the cases of missing and murdered Indigenous women from their communities. Through the family stories, it is clear that state solutions to addressing the issue of violence against Aboriginal women are inadequate and are in fact part of perpetuating the ongoing issue. On September 6, 2008, two Algonquin girls, Maisie Ojik and Shannon Alexander, disappeared from the Kitikanzibi Anishinaabeg First Nations Reserve in Maniwaki, Quebec, about 140 kilometers north of Ottawa. Laurie Ojik, Maisie's mother, tells the story of the girl's disappearance and police and media failures.
My name is Laurie Ojik, and I'm from Kitikanzibi. Maisie is a very free-spirited girl. She loves her family. She loves drawing and designing. She's into music, and she's just all around very lovable and likable girl. I knew Shannon. I mean, she's a really nice girl. Her and Maisie are very, very close friends.
Though the girls were deemed runaways, it was a suspicious disappearance from the start. The girls left behind their belongings, including their cell phones and wallets.
The last time I saw Maisie was on the Friday. I had went to my mom's and to drop off a pot of hers that I had, and Maisie and Shannon were there mowing my mom's lawn on the Friday. And I spoke to Maisie and asked her what she was planning on doing for the weekend, and she told me that they were making some money and because they wanted to go to the dance that evening, and that she was spending the weekend at Shannon's because Shannon's dad was going to the city to help out Shannon's brother. And Maisie wanted to spend the weekend with her so she wouldn't be alone. And I kissed her and I hugged her, and that was the last time I seen her. After the weekend, we haven't heard from her, and we called the police, and that's when things started from there. As far as I know, they went missing together because they were together. After we reported the girls missing, not much happened. We were at a loss of what to do next and where to go. And what upset me most was that no search was done for the girls at all, because the police put out that they were runaways, and that did a lot of damage for them through the media. Even after he recanted that, that the girls, they had no proof of them running away, the damage was done. But I still wondered why nothing was done for the girls. There was no searches done. I myself and some friends and family members did a search of our own. We even put boats in the river, and we drove down the river looking. And only 6 months later, when Maisie's aunt had made a call out to Search and Global Rescue One, where they actually came down and helped our family. But this was actually supposed to have been done by the police, which was never done. But when they came down and they helped us out, and we even got Missing Children's Society of Canada involved, because a lot of things were done wrong for the girls, and they weren't done for the girls. And they came down and they did an investigation of their own, and they also felt things weren't done right for them, but it was too late because all of the evidence would have diminished, I guess, over time, and that not much can be done now. And everything should have been done from the beginning. And till this day, I'm still fighting for some justice for my daughter. And what's sad about it, that there's no legal help out there for me. Everywhere I turn, I get doors closed, and, you know, because my daughter's rights were violated because she did not get a proper investigation into her case. And I know my daughter, she would have never, ever done this to her family. In my heart, I do hope that the police are right and that they did run away. But the inside of me, I know something went wrong somewhere, and I just don't feel right about it at all. There was no reward offered by our police over here. The only thing that was really done was that the band made a donation to the reward. And the reward webpage was set up by Maisie's aunt, and every year we have events to raise money for our reward, you know. I mean, we're landed almost at 20,000, and you know what? That's not enough. I mean, even through the media, when these other children go missing, it's unbelievable on the reward amounts that they get within a few days, and we don't get that. There was none of that. And as to why, there's no media coverage for these girls. There's no support in asking for help to raise money for a reward for these girls. And as for the police, I'm just dumbfounded at the lack of support that my family got from them. And I am not shy to say that, because there was none. None whatsoever, no support. I think they came to my house once, the police, and that was to fill out forms for the girls, for Maisie, sorry, and that was it. You know, and I even asked a question one time as to why, you know, they didn't give me a call, and I got a rude remark back saying, well, you know where we are, why don't you call us? So what does that tell you? You know, we as a family are struggling and, you know, going through this hell of not knowing where our loved one is, and you get met with rudeness and no empathy at all, no nothing whatsoever. I was really upset at that remark, and it stuck with me because I can't believe someone from my own community told me that, you know, and that hurts because, you know what, it is a part of their job. They're supposed to contact our families with anything or any news whatsoever, and I think they were upset with me because of things I've said through the newspapers and, you know, of the lack of support. And you know what? I'm not lying. You know, the support we got from our band here, they held a couple of searches, but that's only after I raised a big kind of stink about it that things were done, because nothing was done. I had to contact my own, you know, chief and counsel to help me. Where was the knock on my door at the time? Why weren't people that are supposed to help you, why weren't they here to help our family and to knock on our door and say if there was anything we needed or anything they can do? Not much was done for Shannon either, because SQ has Shannon's file, and Kittygon GB Police here have Maisie's file. And that was another big question for me, was why were the girls files separated at the beginning because, you know, I read up on the law and where the means happened, that's police jurisdiction. And where they went missing was in the town of Maniwaki. So this file, both files should have belonged to the SQ. Police here on our community had, you know, had one file and the SQ and the other. I think it was just them not really, you know, knowing what they were doing or how to handle such a case, because they even said it through the media that this was their first case ever that happened. And, you know, so what does that tell you? That my daughter was first case and they kind of blew it. Not trying to put them down on their abilities or, you know, bash them, but things weren't done right for her. And that's where I stand with that. There was even offered of help through the RCMP, and that was refused. So if they didn't, they didn't even have a policy and procedure on missing children. You know, one was just developed 2 years ago. Well, maybe about a year after the girls went missing, I think one was developed and put through. So there's things I don't understand, but I do understand. I just don't understand why they chose not to do anything. You look at the media, and when someone else, you know, goes missing, you know, all these people come together, and there's searches, and there's helicopter searches, and, you know, there's ground crews looking. Maisie and Shannon never got any of that. Nothing. I always state that, I don't know if you remember the Boomer the Lion here, that went loose in our community, he got more attention than the girls did. And that's just not right.
CBC Archives, Wednesday, April 30th, 2008. This just in. A male African lion cub is thought to be roaming near Maniwaki, Quebec, on Wednesday after escaping from its owner the night before. Quebec Provincial Police spokesperson Melanie LaRouche said the animal was last seen around 9:30 p.m. on Highway 105, about 1 kilometer south of Maniwaki, a community about 145 kilometers north of Ottawa. Ruby Whiteduck, who was related to the owner, said the animal named Boomer escaped from a home at Kirigonzibi, Algonquin First Nation Reserve, after being taken out for a walk Tuesday evening and then tied with a dog leash. Corporal Gordon McGregor of the Kirigonzibi Reserve Police Force said police had set up a security perimeter and were now looking for the animal and deploying a helicopter equipped with a heat-seeking camera Wednesday afternoon to help with the search. Quote, "In the meantime, we're putting out a security message to all of our community members and those at the town of Maniwaki to stay near their kids, be careful, don't go out at night, and especially don't go out in the woods." This has been today's breaking news.
You know, and to top it all off, he was a little baby lion, you know, and all this media attention around that was phenomenal. And when two Native girls went missing, there was nothing.
Tiffany Morrison was 25 years old when she went missing. She's a Mohawk woman from Ganawage Mohawk Reserve, 20 minutes southwest of Montreal. Her mother, Carol, and sister, Melanie, tell the story of Tiffany's disappearance and of the family's experience piecing together the poorly addressed case.
On June 18th, 2006, my sister went out for the evening and never came home after that. After calling around and doing a lot of research on our part, we found out where she ended up. She actually ended up at a bar in LaSalle, the Haraki. She went there with a couple of her friends. When she got there, we don't know why she was, but she decided to take a cab back with an individual from town. So according to the individual, they flagged down a taxi outside the bar. They came to town. He got off at his residence, and he said that Tiffany continued on to her house as far as he knew, and that she had money, enough money to make it there. That's where the trail ends, because there's no record of the taxi, of the fare, because the practices of the outside taxis in LaSalle and Montreal, majority of the taxi drivers that pick up people that are coming to the reserve don't call it in, don't mark it down. They pocket the money. The owners of the cab companies, there's three in the area that my sister flagged down the taxi, all said that they're aware of the situation, but the taxi drivers do it and there's nothing they can do. So that's kind of like the wall that we're up against now, because we can't trace that taxi. There's no way to make the taxi companies tell us who was working that night, because they said without a court order they won't release their workers' names for that evening. When we went to the PKs here in town, we hadn't known what happened to her yet. We went to make a missing persons report. We filled up the file. We gave the details as to what she was wearing, the date that she was last seen. And we were told, oh, don't worry about it, you know, they usually come back in a day or two, you know, or she might be just off somewhere with somebody, and, you know, they basically kind of didn't take it serious. We informed them that she never goes out and doesn't call if she's not coming back. She has a small daughter, and she would always call and tell us if she wasn't going to be back on time, or if she was staying out the night, so her daughter knows that she wasn't going to be there. So it was very unlike her not to call, not to contact. We had no idea where she was. After, I guess, about a week, we went to find out what was being done, and they're like, oh, well, we've never had a case where the person never came back. We've always had just where, oh, well, they stayed out. They decided to go up north with somebody, and they just didn't call home. So it was their first actual case of an actual missing person. And they basically didn't know what they were doing as far as we were concerned, because my mother called around her friend, Tiffany's friends and that, and asking them if anybody knew where she was. And it was my mother who located where my sister had started off in town, whose house she was at. And then from there, we had to tell the PKs to go there and speak to the person. And it was actually told to us that one of the PKs was friends with this individual and said that, oh no, well, he said that he didn't know anything, so they were going to take it at a face value that, you know, she wasn't there or there's nothing to be done. After pushing the issue quite a lot, they finally went and interviewed the individual to find out, well, where did she go? Like after she left your house? And it turns out that his friend from outside the community was playing in a band at the Haraki bar and said, well, I didn't go. He goes, I stayed home, but she went with my friend, and they went to the bar and she went to watch them play. So that led us to the bar. They went to the bar, they asked around, and it was actually one of the barmaids that remembered my sister being there and called in and said that she remembers my sister leaving with a guy from town, but she couldn't remember his name. So she told the investigator that when the individual came back in, she would call so that he could come there and that she would point him out. I don't remember how long it took, because apparently the guy was a regular there. They found out who the individual was, and they called up the individual, and the individual said, well, I didn't know I was the last one to be seen with her, so I didn't bother to call. By this time, we had word of mouth was going around. I think the poster missing persons was already out, and he said that, well, I didn't realize I was the last person to be seen with her. From there, he said he doesn't remember what cab, he doesn't remember what the driver looks like, he couldn't give any details as to, he said, I don't even know if the light on top of the taxi was yellow or orange. He goes, I really don't know. He said, I don't know why I left early. He goes, I know I was home early, but I don't remember what time. The barmaid actually had more information than he did. Like, she knew about what time they had left the bar, and he was like, all no details at all, no recollection. He said he didn't know if he was drunk or if he was sick or he had, you know, something to do that he went home that early, because apparently, I guess, he doesn't go home at an early hour. So then that's when the PKs went to speak to the cab companies, and they told them about the practices and that they don't mark down the fares, and that without the court order, they can't release the names, because they asked for them to give them the names of the taxi drivers that were working in that area. And since then, nothing's been said. The taxi companies took her poster, said they would send out a memo to all the drivers that if anybody remembers this cab fare, to come forward and say something. Well, nobody did, because they don't want to get in trouble for taking the fares here without claiming it. The Missing Children's Network was on our part to get her poster up. We did the research to get her poster on the site. We just had to get the okay from the investigator to be contacted by the organization to give the file number. That was all done on our part. With no lead, that's what it all falls back on. No information from the last person with her on the taxi, at least to narrow it down, something. Nothing at all. So there's no information as to which cab company it was, what the driver looked like. So they have no evidence. They can't get a court order without the evidence. So everything revolves around finding evidence, but we can't get ahead because we can't get to the next step. I don't know why they're allowed to do it. I don't know why, if the owners are aware that they're doing it, that they're allowed. But we're actually going to be petitioning the Minister of Justice to find out why these practices are being allowed to take place, and that this, and hopefully it'll bring awareness that this type of thing can happen when those practices are overlooked and not followed up on. You know, why is it okay to not jot down fares that come to this community, but if they pick anybody else up from outside the community, they have to call it in? They're putting it right into their pocket. If they claim it, they have to give a portion to the company and they have to claim it. We don't have the same level of crime here, so a lot of the stuff they don't deal with. Less people, less, thank God, less major crime. So when something like they're used to somebody stayed out, teenager took off for the weekend, but for an actual missing person, they never dealt with it. They're used to in a day, maybe a week, person comes back and that's it. I think they need to take every case serious, regardless what their prior experience with this type of thing is. They shouldn't base it off other people that took off for weekends and that. Somebody comes to you and says, my child's missing. She didn't come home. We haven't had contact. Nobody can find her. They should open the file and treat it right off the start as that person's missing. We lost a lot of time because of the attitude. She'll just come back, We see it all the time. And then they find out that it's not just, she didn't just go out for the evening and take off for the weekend and come back whenever. I think we would have had more fresh memories if it had been followed up on right away, and we didn't have to go and call everybody and contact everybody and find out where she went and then keep on them to go and interview this person to find out. Then we would have been led to the bar sooner. The waitress's memory would have been better. The guy wouldn't have been able to say, well, I don't remember, because it took so long to get to that point. He's a regular at a bar, so his memory is is like foggy. So maybe if we would have got to him sooner, the people that were there that night could have remembered more. He might have remembered more. Somebody might have remembered being outside, seeing them get in the cab, something. So if I think it was the time frame, the time that was lost because it was treated as just another person that stayed out, uttered and treating it as an actual missing persons file that it was opened as, caused a lot of the standstill. So we lost the trail. I think by the time we got to the individual, it was almost a month.
My family and friends, we were the ones that went to houses, to the clubs, to go and check everybody out. Anybody knows anything. They never bothered till maybe a month, and went and checked on the same things we did.
The investigation, we did the legwork, and then, you know, well, they were sitting around going, ah, she'll be back. We were the ones going and making the phone calls and tracking down the people and then pointing them in the direction. Like, when I started, I had no idea what I was doing. I just knew, like, now something needed to be done with the community. It's going to be 3 years now. That's way too long to go with not a word. There was next to no media coverage. Once we had the poster up for the Missing Children's Network, the police put it in the eastern door. By this point, it was so far gone. You know, it was no help whatsoever, as well as trying to get the outside media involved was a no-go at all. It took one of the other investigators that had a friend with the Gazette to ask for a favor to get them to do a piece on the story. That attracted a little attention from one French television station, and then we got CTV to come. They ran her story for one night. It was like in the fall to early winter. It was far past. Since then, for media coverage, it's only been in our local paper, and recently they won't even run her poster. We call, we spoke into them. The only time they want to do anything on her is if there's a search done or if there's a new rumor going around and they want to confirm if it's true. But other than that, they won't. I've contacted them and it's always, oh, well, we don't have space this week, next week for sure. And it hasn't been ran since last fall. At that time, they assured us that every 3 months it would be in the paper to keep the community informed, and it was never run.
Every day you listen for the phone to ring, some news, here somebody pulls in the driveway, you run to the door, always expecting to see her, and I'm just, like, you're just on the verge, you can't never give up, you're always waiting for her to walk through the door, Mom, I'm home, and somehow it's never happened in 3 years. It's, I don't know, just, you can't give up, you just have to keep hoping.
Melanie and Carol Morrison were left to organize searches themselves for Tiffany's body around the time of her disappearance. Members from Missing Justice, a grassroots solidarity campaign based in Montreal, attended the search for Tiffany's body while the family and community members searched for her. Still without a court order to allow for the questioning of the man who was with Tiffany in the taxi at the time of her disappearance, and still no court order to question and demand that the cab company release the names of the cab drivers who were working the night of Tiffany's disappearance, and without any real action to bring justice to Tiffany's case. A year after this interview with Carol and Melanie, in June of 2010, 4 years after Tiffany had gone missing, Tiffany's remains were found by a construction worker under the Mercier Bridge, and parts of her skull were located along Highway 138. There has still been no trial into the disappearance and murder of Tiffany Morrison, and the family is still seeking justice. You're listening to a special documentary about the stories of Shannon Alexander, Maisie Ogic, Gladys Tolley, and Tiffany Morrison, four of the missing and murdered Indigenous women in Quebec.
We'll be back after this musical break
featuring Mo Clark's piece, Butterfly Ashes. Listening to a radio documentary about the stories of missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Quebec. We will now hear the story of Gladys Tolley, who was struck and killed by a Sûreté de Québec police officer on October 4th, 2001. It's a story about the police investigating themselves, committing murder, and getting away with complete impunity. Bridget Tolley tells the story of her mother's murder by two police officers and her family's pursuit for justice.
My name is Bridget Tolley. I'm a grandmother from the Kittagong ZB First Nation Reserve in Quebec. My mom, she was a really soft-spoken person. She loved everybody, and she really liked to be outdoors. She liked fishing, hunting, that sort of stuff. She really liked her fish, though. This was one thing. She liked to catch her own fish, and she liked to cook that. She made, like, soup and stuff like that, all kind of good stuff to eat. And she was a really nice, gentle person. She had six kids, and she had about, let me see, there was about approximately 18 of us then when she got killed in 2001. My mother was having a beer over at my sister's house, and she lived right across the road from her own house, and it was on a highway. It was on the reserve. It was called Highway 105, and she lived directly across the road from my sister, so it wasn't like a big, long walk or anything. So approximately around 11:30, she was going home. She was crossing the road, and I'm not sure if she fell down or if she was standing up, but the police had hit her. There was two police officers in the car when she got killed, and one of them thought she was a sign, and one of them thought she was a dog. But the thing was, before my mother got hit, there was a vehicle that had flashed the police to let them know that something was on the road, and this is why I think my mother fell down and she was trying to get back up. This vehicle, there was two people on it, and they tried to warn the police there was something there, and the police had like about 900 meters before they struck and killed my mother, so I figured they were going pretty fast. And the brother of the cop that struck and killed my mother was in charge of the scene, too. So not only was it conflict of interest to have the Sûreté de Québec police on the scene doing the investigation, I found out it was the brother. Not only did he have one brother on the scene, he had two brothers. There was no witness statement. Nobody saw my mother's body except for police. There was a procedure that when something like this happens to somebody like my mother that gets killed on the highway, the procedure is you bring that person to the hospital and the doctor declares them dead at the hospital, then the morgue takes you from the hospital. Well, this didn't happen to my mother. The Sûreté de Québec went to the hospital. They got the doctor from the Maniwaki Hospital. This is the Quebec police that just killed my mother are doing all this. And why they didn't want to bring my mother to the hospital like normal or usual procedure, I don't know. They got that doctor, brought that doctor to the scene where my mother was on the road, and the doctor pronounced her dead on the road, and the Sûreté de Québec police brought that doctor back to the hospital. So the only person to see my mother was that one doctor. The rest were all police. They didn't even allow the family to identify the body. So what happened in my mother's case was that the Sûreté de Québec killed my mother. It was a conflict of interest for the brothers to even be involved or even to be in charge of the scene. And then we have the Kittagong ZB police that have a police agreement signed by the federal, provincial, and the Kittagong ZB reserve. Then we have the Montreal police. So the three police forces are paid by the government of Quebec. The Indian police had jurisdiction to protect the body and the scene, and this was not done. So, and all the people that are involved and that were at the scene were all police officers, all paid by the government of Quebec. they helped each other. And this is the reason why now the police force is talking to me. What they did was they went to take pictures of all the beer bottles and stuff inside the houses. Instead of taking pictures at the scene, there's no pictures of that, but they tried to take pictures of every beer bottle they found in both yards and in the houses just to make it look like my mother died because she was drunk and not because she got hit by the car. About 3 months after my mom died, the case was closed, and I didn't know anything about it till like November. It was 13 months later when I found out that the case was closed from a newspaper reporter, too. He called me and asked me, how do I feel about the case being closed? We never spoke to the police forces. None of the three police forces ever came speak to us. They all act like, you know, they did something wrong because none of them ever wanted to talk about it or anything. Not only that, 3 months after my mother got killed, the police that was involved in the accident, it seemed like they were all being transferred. They didn't want to talk to me or anything, nothing at all. But I went through access to information. I went through everything. I went knock on everybody's door in Quebec. The coroner never wanted to answer my questions or even talk to me. He never answered my calls. Nothing. Absolute zero. I had a hard time to get any information. First of all, I had to ask for a coroner's report. Of course, they sent it to me in French. I wanted to read in English so I can have the exact words, you know. So right away, they wanted to charge me $10 for the translation of the coroner's report. And I said, geez, you know, maybe there's something that they don't want me to see or anything. So when I got the report, I found out there was a couple of things that weren't true on the coroner's report. For instance, he said that the body was identified by a family member. And I knew that wasn't true because they didn't let any of our family see my mother. And another thing on the coroner's report was that the coroner never saw my mother neither. So the coroner made this report based on what the police said in their report. And there was a coroner in Maniwaki when this happened, and the town of Maniwaki is right beside the reserve. And they didn't call this coroner. They had called a coroner from Gatineau, which is approximately an hour and a half away from the reserve. So they called a coroner that didn't even see the body or anything instead of calling this coroner. There were so many things wrong with the case. There was the date, the time, even the address was wrong. So anyway, after I saw that coroner's report, that's when I was interested because there was mistakes in there. I said, oh my God, I can just imagine the police report. And then I tried to get that and I couldn't do it on my own. I had to get a lawyer to get the report, and that cost me about $1,000. But now after I got the report, I sort of knew why they didn't want me to see that report because, like I said, there were so many mistakes in there. There's so much neglect by the police, not only in my mother's case. We have two missing girls from my reserve also. So it's hard dealing with them, especially when they have no support. So it's hard. I know how the police are. I know the way that we are treated. So many families, the same with Maisie and Shannon, they were treated as runaways from the beginning. And they said, oh, yeah, they said they'll be back whenever, you know. And it's hard to start off like that. And look at today, you know, they end up searching for these girls when there was 2 feet of snow. They went missing in September, and the first search party was in December. You know, we had Boomer the Lion there, and you should have seen the police and the game wardens and everybody. And Boomer was my neighbor there. He lived next door to me. And you should have seen all the police and everybody. And they knew what to do when it was a baby lion, but they didn't know what to do when we had two missing girls, you know. So if they don't know how to do this and they don't know what to do, that it's conflict of interest for the Sûreté to be investigating themselves, they shouldn't even be there. What the heck are they there for? My God, they were able to find that lion within 24 hours when the girls came to Sûreté du Québec, and the Kitigan-ZB police did not help search. They stood there and they waited and watched. You know, it was pretty sad. But this happens all across Canada. We have big problems with the police.
Over 10 years have passed since the murder of Bridget's mother, Gladys Toley. And today, Bridget and her family are still fighting to have a public investigation into the murder of her mother by two Sûreté du Québec police officers. The provincial government of Quebec have ruled that the case of her mother's death is closed. But Bridget continues to demand that the federal government overturn Quebec's decision that allows for this case to remain closed, and for the Sûreté du Québec police force to commit murder and get away without any accountability to Bridget, her family, or their community. Bridget continues to fight for a public investigation into the murder of her mother, Gladys Toley, by Sûreté du Québec police officers. In 2010, the funding for the Sisters in Spirit initiative was cut. This was groundbreaking research that, for the first time, gathered data and statistics about the numbers of missing and murdered Native women across Canada. Bridget Toley founded the organization Families of Sisters in Spirit as a response to the funding cuts to Sisters in Spirit and as a means to continue the fight of all the families of missing and murdered Aboriginal women across the country, in demanding that the government cooperate in creating solutions to the epidemic rates of violence against Indigenous women, in demanding that police treat the cases of missing and murdered Native women with respect, dignity, and urgency. Families of Sisters in Spirit is only one of the many grassroots initiatives that have formed across the country in response to mainstream Canada's failure and ignorance in addressing this issue.
The Sisters in Spirit initiative started in 2005 till 2010. I actually met Bev Jacobs in 2004, right before it began. So I was fortunate to be one of the family members that was there since the beginning of Sisters in Spirit. And, it was going great. You know, there were so many things being done, so much awareness. In 2006, I was working on my mom's case again, and I wanted to try and get an MP or somebody to bring her case inside Parliament, but I couldn't do that. So I said, well, I'm going to at least bring her outside, you know. And I was thinking and thinking, and I had to figure out a way to bring her outside. I knew I could have a vigil or something. But then again, I knew they were forgetting about not only my mother, but all the missing and murdered women. So I had asked Amnesty and the Native Women of Canada to help me honor my mother and all the missing and murdered women.
Every year on October 4th, the anniversary of Gladys Toley's death, the Sisters in Spirit vigils take place across the country and across borders. These vigils take place to recognize that the violence experienced by Aboriginal women and girls in Canada is a national tragedy, and to take the time to give thanks to the families who have inspired the Sisters in Spirit movement and who are still fighting to demand that action be taken.
And we started our first vigil in 2006. We had 11 cities across Canada participate with us. And in 2010, when the government took away the funding, there was close to 100 cities across Canada, and I think we had even a couple internationally. So we were bringing so much awareness, and, you know, people like the Sisters in Spirit vigils. Then all of a sudden, at the end of 2010, they said, okay, well, no more Sisters in Spirit. The funding's cut, and we're not continuing it. And I said, oh, my goodness sakes, you know, that we can't just let it go. And just because Prime Minister Harper doesn't want to have the Sisters in Spirit You know, I said, we can't just forget about it. We've come too far. And that's when I decided to start a group called Families of Sisters in Spirit, because I thought it was important that we keep the name Sisters in Spirit. I didn't think it was fair for them just to just give us that 5 years, then take it all away from us and say, okay, well, you guys are done now, you know. No more counting how many more women will be missing for, and no more advocacy, and no more using the name Sisters in Spirit. I thought it was very important we continue. We call ourselves Families of Sisters in Spirit. We continued with the vigils. You know, I figured we better fight for this, or else we would have been another chapter in Harper's history book, you know, and I wasn't ready to be a part of that history yet. My mother's case is not even close from being where I want to be, you know. So I can't just stop and say, okay, well, no more Sisters in Spirit, no more nothing, and what are we going to do, you know? Because families fight for justice no matter what, you know. This is 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and nobody helps us. Nobody helps us when we're out there, you know. Nobody helps me pay my gas when I'm going to access the information, going to meet with AFN. When families do things like this, they do it by themselves, you know. Oh, and as you can see with the Maisie and Shannon, the families had to do their own search. So we have to do this, and we don't wait for anybody's funding or anything. We continue our journey, and this is why, you know, like I said, it doesn't matter who gets funding to me or not, because my justice continues, my journey continues, and I'm going to continue to fight for my mother and all the rest of the missing women. I think it's very important that we continue to honor and remember them.
Families of Sisters in Spirit is currently working on a database so they can continue to keep track of the cases of Aboriginal women that go missing or are murdered every year, since the government is no longer funding such research. It is crucial that we are able to keep updated statistics about these numbers in order to continue building upon campaigns that demand that the government take adequate action and fund initiatives that address the epidemic rates of violence experienced by Aboriginal women across the country, including alternative task forces for families to turn to report cases of missing Aboriginal women, as it is clear that the police are incompetent and corrupt when it comes to responding to these cases. By the request of the Native Women's Association of Canada and the Canadian Feminist Alliance for International Action, a United Nations inquiry into missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada is underway. This inquiry will investigate the human rights abuses committed on the bodies of Aboriginal women, lack of response to this issue. The Canadian government does not want this United Nations inquiry to take place, because they know that violence against Aboriginal women in Canada is a national disgrace. But the families of missing and murdered Aboriginal women across Canada and their allies continue to raise their voices and demand justice. We must continue to tell the stories of Gladys Toley, Tiffany Morrison, Maisie Ojik, and Shannon Alexander, and the stories of all the other missing and murdered Indigenous women across Turtle Island. We continue to tell their stories as a means of resistance, because their stories matter. This documentary was produced by Candice Cascanet at CKUT radio station in Montreal, Quebec, on Mohawk territory. Special thanks to Megan Bertison for her profound words, which inspired this radio documentary. Thanks to Courtney Kirkby and Maya Rolbingani for the audio they contributed. Thank you to Bridget Toley, Lori Ojik, and Melanie and Carol Morrison for sharing their stories. This documentary featured music by Tanya Tagak, Caribou, Fortet, and Mo Clark.